All right. Thank you so much for being here, everyone. This is Creating Vibrant Cities Through Nighttime Culture and Entrepreneurship. We really appreciate you being here. We're excited to talk about this topic. What it's about is why nightlife culture is important to creating vibrant cities and why we need to support it and some strategies for how we can support it. That's our session, and let's get into it.
Next slide, please. Why don't you introduce yourself, Brian?
All right, well then I guess I'll keep talking. I'm Brian Block from right here in Austin. I'm the Nightlife and Entertainment Services Manager with the City of Austin, focusing on, you know, nightlife management and advocacy. And then you can also see Nightcap up there. One of the founders of the nonprofit organization Nightcap, which is purpose is advancing nighttime management and nighttime advocacy in U.S. cities.
I guess we'll jump here. Good morning, everyone. Pardon me, I'm usually out at night. So I am Raheem Manning. I'm the director of nighttime economy and business development for the City of Philadelphia, more commonly known as Philly's first ever nighttime mayor. And so I represent all the interests of our city after five. That's creating policies, but also supporting businesses, people, and organizations that operate after five, representing artists' interests within city government and making sure that our policies reflect the needs of artists. But it's also not just the fun stuff at nightlife, like our bars, clubs, venues, entertainment, but it's also lighting, design, safety, transportation, third shift workers, and access to services. And so I'm excited to be here with you this morning to talk about nightlife, but we're gonna have a great session today.
Great. Hi, everyone. Ben Van Houten from San Francisco. I'm the business development manager for the nightlife and entertainment sector in our Office of Economic and Workforce Development, which is a lengthy and convoluted title. But I work on policy, program, advocacy to support nightlife and entertainment in San Francisco. Been doing it since 2013, which I think makes me the longest serving nighttime manager in the U.S. Still cautiously leaning into that, but and also serving as president of Nightcap, the Nighttime Economy, Culture, and Policy Alliance that these fellows are also a part of.
Yeah, I would say also a board member of Nightcap as well.
Hi, folks. I'm Lauren Gashinsky. I am a nightlifer. I've worked in the nightlife sector and kind of crossed between nightlife and the arts during the daytime for almost 15 years now. I founded a festival that brought those things together called VIA many years ago. I'm on the board of Resident Advisor, supporting the company and also supporting artisan scenes across Canada, the US, Mexico, and South America. And I am a mentor for artists and entrepreneurs at New Inc., which is part of the New Museum in New York City.
All right, I'm gonna give you our very brief opening statement and then we're gonna get into it. South by Southwest is now a global event, but it originated here in Austin, of course, in 1987 as a music festival with 700 people in attendance. The purpose was to advance the local music and creative communities and by extension, advance these communities in cities everywhere. So it couldn't be more fitting that we're here to talk about nightlife culture, why it's important, and how supporting it creates vibrant cities. Nightlife, entertainment, arts, culture, and live music help make cities unique and authentic. They attract companies and tourism, celebrate local culture, and build community. They're often multi-billion dollar economic impact engines for cities as well. But beyond the economic value, which is significant, live music and arts and culture nourish our spirits and souls, connect us to innovative ideas and expression, and build communities. The nightlife space is often where this is performed and presented. It's the independent artists, promoters, and entrepreneurs that drive the nightlife culture in a city. Nightlife culture makes cities great places where people want to live. It makes our lives in those cities nourishing and fulfilling. So we need to ensure that independent nightlife can thrive in cities. And that's what this session is about.
Awesome. Next slide, please. I'd also like to root us in the history of nightlife. I'm sure as many of you know, nightlife has been a liberatory space for over 100 years in the United States. And it is deeply intertwined with civil rights, human rights, and also the relationships that we make not only with each other, but how we shape cities. And this is just a little bit of a history lesson. Cafe Society in New York City that put on artists like Billie Holiday were one of the first racially integrated clubs in the United States. But it faced a lot of challenges from the feds, from local government, and from community members not necessarily supporting and appreciating spaces like this. So when we think about nightlife today, I think it's really important that we acknowledge that history and think about what that looks like today and how we can keep advancing nightlife to support its legacy. Next slide. All right, so obviously nightlife, we think of fun. It is very fun. It is really great. But we want to approach nightlife today through three lenses. We want to think about how to preserve nightlife, how to protect nightlife, and how to advance nightlife. Many different sectors and many different approaches come together here. We're talking about culture. We're talking about community. We're talking about spaces. We're talking about policy. We're talking about business. This is my innovation. CB brain. I can't even see this. I made this slide, and I can't even remember this. We're talking about business, and we're talking about innovation, different ways that we innovate the nightlife space. Next slide, please. Brian?
All right. So we're going to start with preserve, and then we're going to move on to the other two topics, protect and advance. When we talk about preservation and nightlife culture, starting with Austin and live music is a great place to start. Live music is part of the heart and soul of the city and the culture. It's kind of commonly understood as part of the community identity here. So I'm going to start with a little bit of the origin story. Like other origin stories, it's a sacred story. So I hope I'll do it justice. It's essential to the heart and soul of the community. You've probably heard of the branding, the live music capital of the world, and that's certainly part of it. You know, we've got sort of mixed feelings about that here, but ultimately I think it's a good thing, and I'll tell you a little bit about why that is. I think it's undeniable that live music is a genuine and authentic, important part of the local culture and the local economy. And that's not a new thing. That sort of goes back, half a century and is sort of bound up in sort of the growth of the city and this since the 1960s, when this was a progressive bubble. And it was a magnet for creative ideas, innovation for artists, for musicians, a place where different ideas were not only accepted, but encouraged. And sort of that, 1960s, it was a magnet for the culture, but it was also able to thrive here. Being open to progressive ideas and innovation and culture and music and being cheap and affordable. That's a big part of it and why it thrived and sort of over the decades really grew. So the live music capital branding, why is that sort of, why are there mixed feelings about it? That became something in the 1990s that was used to brand and market the city. And I think rightly so, the music community over the years at different times has said, this is important. We're talking about it. We're branding the city. We're promoting tourism with it. But what are we doing to support the culture, the ecosystem, the independent artists, promoters, and venues? And so ultimately, I think the live music capital branding is a good thing. It's a constant reminder that it's an aspirational goal and that it's something active that, you know, we need to support. And, you know, this, we see this as, this preservation is something active. It's making sure that this culture and this ecosystem can thrive into the future, not just remembering old buildings or, you know, putting markers in place. On the screen, go back to the some of the historic venues. You can see some historic venues here going all the way back to the 1950s, Charlie's Playhouse, which was in the African American Cultural District in an important blues space, all the way back to the 1950s. The Vulcan Gas Company in the 1960s. This is part of the dirt road to psychedelia. Rocky Erickson coming out, you know, 1960s was an important time for live music in Austin. The Armadillo World Headquarters in the 1970s. Liberty Lunch in the 80s and 90s. The Black Cat and other bars on 6th Street in the 90s, Emos in the 90s and aughts. These are revered spaces in Austin because they were the center of the live music scene at the time, and they sort of connect to our kind of love of live music in the city and the culture. They're not here anymore. Some legacy venues are, Antone's, the Continental Club, Hole in the Wall, still here, and I'll talk a little bit about how they're being preserved. But now there's new venues that are becoming our new legacy venues. The Mohawk, Hotel Vegas, Cheer Up Charlie's, a really cool, important space that's both an LGBTQ community space and a live music venue. So we're moving forward. But we're no longer in that time where there's cheap rents. We're now having a lot of, you know, there's no more dark corners of downtown or really anywhere where places can thrive, where venues and artists can thrive. We're having commercial affordability crisis and displacement pressure on artists and on independent venues and spaces. So what are we going to do to preserve it going forward, to preserve places, to preserve venues in place as best we can? And if we can't, make sure that this culture can continue to thrive. I'm going to cover three strategies, three things we're doing here to preserve the culture, preserve live music. One is funding. And part of that funding, it's funding for artists, but it's also funding for commercial venues. So being able to support commercial venues with funding is something that we've done that's important. I'll just kind of quickly cover four things that we're doing with funding, both in the state and locally. Statewide, there's a fairly new alcohol tax rebate for venues. If they meet the definition of a live music venue, they qualify for up to $100,000 in rebates. Locally here in Austin, the city council created an economic development corporation to either buy property and make it permanently affordable for venues or make a long-term lease affordable. The Hole in the Wall was preserved with a $2.6 million investment. And using hotel occupancy tourism taxes, a live music fund was created. It supports artists. And hopefully in the coming year, it'll support venues as well. That's a sustainable source of funding that will go on indefinitely. I want to talk a little bit about land use. And as venues and spaces are displaced from the center to the periphery, how do we make sure they can continue to exist and be viable and sustainable? And one way we've done that is to define performance venue as something different from a bar and different from a restaurant and different from a theater. And it's we've made it easier to create those things by not requiring bar zoning for it. And then lastly, what I want to touch on is having regulations that are geared to preserving and sustaining venues. One of the things we do well here is a really robust and intentional focus on sound management that has hours and sound levels that allow live music. It's not an afterthought. It was developed with live music in mind. And it's, you know, it's not loud music allowed everywhere, but where it is allowed, it's objective and it's predictable, and we don't change it when residential moves in nearby. That's maintained, so they're not at risk of that kind of displacement. So those are some of the things we're doing here to preserve the live music culture. And Ben, over to you for some comments on San Francisco.
Sure, if we can go back one slide. The story that I'm going to tell about cultural preservation is how cities empower entrepreneurs to carry on culturally important businesses and even hopefully support the growth of new culturally important businesses. This is a picture of the Stud. The Stud is San Francisco's oldest gay bar. It is an incredibly important space for the queer community, and it's a terrific place for live performance and drag. And the Stud has had several locations over its many years and had several owners, but reached a crisis point in the mid-2000s when the owner at the time decided that he wanted to retire, and the business's lease was actually coming up a few years after that. Over a dozen people in the queer community rallied together to buy the business and to plan the future of the Stud, figure out what was working, what wasn't working, and actually formed a cooperative and became the first cooperatively owned nightclub in the United States. The city, so this is a community-driven story, to be very clear, but there are ways that cities can support these stories. First off, through technical assistance that we were working closely with the collective at when they were getting started, and I worked with them for the many years they were looking for their forever home, which they ultimately found. But there are also a couple of really, I think, important policy tools that have been able to help them. So on the next slide, kind of two things I want to highlight. In San Francisco, we have a very robust legacy business program, which emerged out of work and concerns around the decline of legacy bars and restaurants. So from the outset, the program is bigger than nightlife at this point, but it started out of nightlife, out of how do we protect, preserve, retain legacy and important nightlife spaces. Legacy businesses can be added to a registry, and that registry unlocks marketing support, small business support, but also there is a fund, a rent stabilization fund, to help legacy businesses. It provides grants where legacy businesses have secured a 10-year lease or lease extension from their landlord. So again, incentivizing and helping provide resources to keep businesses going. The second tool that helped save the Stud, I think, is the cultural districts program. That we have a number of cultural districts in San Francisco. They're supported by hotel tax money. The Stud was located in and was looking for their permanent space in the Leather and LGBTQ cultural district, which is a district that their mission is really rooted in part in preserving and advancing queer nightlife in Western South of Market, given the decline in those spaces over the recent years. That district and the Stud was looking for a space. They found a space, but it turned out that the zoning wouldn't work for them. It actually was an old queer nightclub that had been zoned out of entertainment during some regressive anti-entertainment zoning in the 1990s. The Stud worked with the Leather District, and they advocated with the Board of Supervisors, overturn the zoning, so that now there can be the Stud could enter that space and offer entertainment, but now also other businesses can be new entertainment venues in our Western South of Market to again try to create new queer entertainment spaces in this important district. So again, a community-driven story, but cities can play several important roles in making this sort of preservation, active preservation work possible.
I'll pick up from here. So when we talk about preserving, we always, you know, traditionally think of it as looking backwards, right? And like freezing things in time. But obviously preserving is an active process. And preserving nightlife in cities, you know, can be really challenging, but I think it begins with folks who love nightlife understanding how cities are made, right? Like all the rules, the laws of the land, understanding how we can change those, but also understanding what historic preservation even means and how it operates. It's super challenging. For example, in New York, CBGB's iconic, but it shut down in the early 2000s because of a lot of different challenges. The irony of CBGB's is that it received historic preservation status for its building after it already closed. So what really bums me out about this one is that the building itself is preserved as a cultural space. It receives all those benefits. But right now, it's a blue chip gallery, and there's a bunch of fashion stores that are sharing that building. So who benefits from that, right? Like, does the legacy of CBGB's benefit? Not necessarily. So when we're looking at historic preservation, you know, there's certain terminology like intangible culture that we can think about and that we can use when we're talking about preserving not only spaces, but the people and activities that go along with it. Anything else you want to say, Raheem?
I think, you know, again, I think we talked a lot about preservation being not just the physical part of it, the club, but it's also about the culture and also preserving, again, safe spaces, a little bit like what you talked about, Ben, for those subcultures that were created because there was no protection or preservation of you know, the nightlife entertainment. And so those are your queer cultures. Those are your Latin cultures. Those are your Black cultures. And I think that's a big part of it. So some of this, the work that we do and needs to continue to be done isn't really about where the money's going or where the protection of the physical place is going, but also opening up opportunities for entrepreneurs and, you know, curators to continue those subcultures that are so important to a city's nightlife. So again, don't actually, when you're thinking about preservation, it's not just about the physical, but it's also about providing new opportunities for new entrepreneurs to come in and create and preserve that culture and that subculture.
Great. Next slide, please.
All right. All that being said, having physical space to socialize and have performances and have cultural activity is also an important tool. And protecting those spaces can mean protecting the ability of those spaces to operate. It can mean protecting the ability of people to be safely in those spaces. So we're going to touch on a couple of different ways of thinking about ways that cities and communities can protect cultural spaces. This is the Independent. It's a live music venue in San Francisco. It's been a live music venue for a couple of decades, and it was a nightclub before that, so a long history as a venue. It had a auto repair shop next door that there was a proposal filed to turn it into a multi-unit apartment building, and people got very concerned. Next slide. Bottom of the Hill, another historic music venue, over 30 years at this point, once named Best Rock Club in the U.S. by Rolling Stone. It's great. It also has been surrounded by a new residential development. And the reason that causes red flags for folks in the nightlife and culture space is that it's a commonly understood saying that, you know, it only takes one dedicated neighbor to shut down a cultural space. And that's the anxiety you see in those headlines on the right-hand side, that they're, you know, venues, one venue once spent over $100,000 in legal fees battling a neighbor who called in complaints on nights where they weren't even open. Which is, again, not to say that all neighbor complaints are unfair, but how do we build systems that can really protect the ability of nightlife spaces to operate, both protecting existing spaces and the ability of entrepreneurs to start new spaces in increasingly dense, mixed-use neighborhoods? So there are two strategies I'd like to touch on here. The first is that San Francisco, two decades ago, out of a lot of conflict between law enforcement and the nightlife community, created an entertainment commission. So prior to that point, entertainment venues were licensed by the police. Police enforced noise complaints. There was a well-founded feeling that licenses were conditioned arbitrarily. People were getting blamed for activity outside of their space. Just the idea of having law enforcement, requiring law enforcement to be the ones to respond to noise complaints seems like a poor use of everybody's resources. So the Entertainment Commission is a civilian-led body, and it focuses on responding to complaints with a mediation first, a bringing people into compliance first approach. The goal is not to get anybody in trouble. The goal is to solve the problems, which involves setting sound limits, it involves developing other sound mitigation strategies. Oftentimes, just building communication lines between neighbors and venues can be really helpful there. Second strategy is several years ago, we went beyond that, and our now mayor, when she was on the Board of Supervisors, adopted what is, I believe, it's at the very least the United States' first version of an agent of change policy, maybe the first in North America. But the idea is that when new residential developments are built near existing music and entertainment venues, that triggers a little bit of additional process, that developers have to reach out to venues, that they can be asked to present at the Entertainment Commission to talk about the mitigations that they're going to do, to make sure that the sound studies that they're doing as they plan development are going to accurately take into account that the venues are nearby. And venues can't be sued if they're operating within the terms of their permits. And neighbors have to get disclosures as well. So it's a robust package of protections that, you know, and the outcomes here, sometimes the outcomes are relatively low cost that would actually improve everybody's well-being. So with the independent, the developer just moved the bedrooms to the other side of the building. And that's a tangible improvement. So really, really proud of these two strategies to support entrepreneurs here.
Ah, yes, protect. So I want to zoom out a little bit here and talk about protecting people. When we think about nightlife, especially today, there are a lot of intersecting issues around harm reduction, right? Making sure that we both have safer space practices inside the club and outside the club. And in New York City, there have been local groups doing this work on the streets, making sure that people are protected for years. In the 90s, New York had one of the first needle exchange programs. And the people that started that work have had a huge influence on nightlife and how we have adopted safer space practices. Next slide, please. So as you can see from my little ecosystem here, folks doing the work out in the streets to protect people have influenced both, you know, educators, researchers, and people looking at harm reduction from a lot of different angles. Club spaces and communities have adopted this in a number of ways and applied that to inside the club, you know, from having safer space monitors and ways to recognize people that can help you when you or someone else are in need. To providing free training programs for Narcan and other harm reduction practices. And what the community has done over the years has influenced policy and has influenced what our cities do now and the services they provide to bars, clubs, and even people on the street. So New York's Office of Nightlife has this program called Narcan Behind Every Bar, which I think is incredible. Every single bar can have a Narcan kit for free. And anybody in New York can contact the Office of Nightlife to receive one for themselves. I think that this kind of distributed training program really looks at safety as a citywide process that we're all sharing in as citizens. We also have some pretty cool things like different distribution center typologies. So, you know, we have what looks like a vending machine. There's so many different ways that we're trying to get these resources into people's hands to help one another. And when we think about protecting nightlife, like you have all mentioned, there's so many different groups, like locally in many different cities, that protect nightlife in their own ways. In New York, we have New York Nightlife United. We have the Independent Venue Association's chapter in New York. We have a longstanding group called Dance Parade that advocates for social dancing as a First Amendment right. Can you believe that it's not? That's a very deep cut, but it's real. Music Workers Alliance that thinks about, you know, the employment of artists, music workers, and people behind the bar. Lots of different groups here. So it really takes an ecosystem of people to protect nightlife and one another.
I think I'll jump a little bit off of what Lauren was talking about with Protect. And what we see a lot of times in Philly and other cities, you know, a lot of the processes to complain about venues and culture are steeped in racism and prohibitive practices, right? So that's why you have systems where one complaint by, you know, one neighbor can complain 100 times, and it registers the same as 100 neighbors, complaining one time. And so a lot of times we have to mitigate that. So changing the policies in which, you know, we accept and receive complaints, because people weaponize city services because they don't like the culture that is at this venue. Not that it's a bar, not that it's loud, but they don't like because Black people are coming in, or that it's an LGBTQ bar, or that it's a Latin bar or something different. And so I think a lot of that is important. And some of the work we did in Philly is also too, you know, making some of these things more by right, bringing down the barriers so that venues can operate and protect, you know, their culture. And so we updated the definition of a nightclub so that, you know, residents at one point, this is a resident-driven thing, the moment you wanted to have live entertainment, it triggered all these other things that you had to get approved. You had to go to an RCO, which is a community organization, in front of a board, right? Giving residents a lot of power, which we want to protect and make sure residents do have a say in how their neighborhood is. But however, those tools were used to be discriminatory. So now with our new definition of a nightclub, when you have live music in your restaurant or, you know, your bar, it's by right now. You don't have to go in front of an RCO or the zoning board to get nightclub zoning, which is the most restrictive zoning. You can still do your restaurant or your bar zoning and add that additional entertainment by right. And that's some of the stuff that you have to think about with protecting, because, again, you know, people weaponize these processes because they just don't like who's there. It's nothing about nuisance.
Okay, I've just got a couple of comments, things I want to emphasize that kind of extend on what Ben and Lauren talked about. So I talked about it during the preservation portion, but I think it's important to emphasize the robust and sort of comprehensive system we have here in Austin for managing entertainment-related sound and making it legal. I think it's important. I'll highlight it again in case it didn't kind of sink in, but I think that's really critical. So sound complaints aren't going to shut down a venue or a bar or a nightclub. You know, they have a right to do it. We are following in San Francisco's footsteps just to be even more kind of proactive and looking at when residential moves in nearby, yeah, you need to do a sound study and you should be aware of what the sound level is in this environment and you should disclose that to residents when they buy or lease the units. And then I'll mention following Lauren, you know, I think, you know, we're behind New York, but hopefully catching up in terms of training and support and guidance for venues and operators and promoters on harm reduction, but then also on sexual assault prevention, drink spiking awareness, things of that nature. We're starting to do more training. So excited about that and want to continue it. There's a little slide way up at the top there. We're excited about our sexual assault victim nonprofit that supports victims of sexual assault, got a grant from the Department of Labor, and they're going to provide training to bars and clubs and venues on bystander intervention and safer spaces. So excited about following and extending on what New York's been up to.
New York has done a great job leading in that harm reduction stuff. But I think, Lauren, you pointed out that that came from the people doing the work and then the government catching up. And I think another thing, Ron, you talked about, and Ben doing great work with that, is I definitely want to put out there with the PROTECT, and we're talking about the residential development, agent of change stuff, it's basically acknowledgement. I think that's a lot of things we see in our cities and our entertainment districts, is that residents come into an area that's already lively, and so we're just saying acknowledge that you're coming into this place. You know that there's going to be a different quality of sound here. There are going to be people moving here, and you're, you know, once you acknowledge that, it's not saying anything bad, but now we can start from, you know, even playing around, because a lot of residents will complain, like, I didn't know this place was so loud. Like, you knew 6th Street was loud, or in Philly, we have South Street, and people move there when they're young and it's hip, and you want to be around all the stuff, and then you get older and you want to complain about it. So I think that's a big part of the protecting, making sure that people are acknowledging where they're going.
Definitely. Next slide, please.
Advance. So back to me, right? All right, so advancing, the culture and creating vibrant cities, it takes a lot of different things, right? And cities have a lot of tools in their tool chest to make a city diverse and vibrant and to attract the type of businesses you want. You know, people see Amazon wants a new headquarters and all these cities are throwing in bids. Well, they're giving these incentives to bring those type of companies in because they bring in jobs, right? But with nightlife, it brings in people, and especially the way we move now, right? Now that there's a remote work environment, people aren't moving just for jobs. They're like looking at that job and like, is the city fun? Is there great restaurants there? You know, other aspects of their quality of life. And so when we're talking about advancing, cities have to change how we are attracting and advancing nightlife in through incentivizing, right? And so one of the things we're looking at in Philly, and I've talked to some of my other counterparts about, is like development incentivizing. So when a new development's coming up, a residential development, they're in front of the city, they're at the zoning board, they have, you know, big lawyers to get all the permits and everything that they need to do. Well, what we're trying to do is say, hey, while you are here doing all this work that is not that major to you, because your company is used to doing this as a developer, while you're in there, earmark some space for entertainment and nightlife. Soundproof it, and also zone it so that now when your development's done and you're wanting to fill that ground level retail, well, me, entrepreneur, I throw parties around the city, I'm ready to open up my own venue, it saves me time because this venue is move-in ready. And I think we see a lot of times where entrepreneurs, you know, they've been promoting, they get their money up and they have the resources, they have the capital to open, but what they lose out in is the time capital. So in Philly, what we see a lot is, okay, great, new club is opening, they find a spot, they sign a lease. You know, the lease comes usually with a rent abatement or, you know, a forbearance. Like, hey, we give you 6 months or sometimes a year to build out, to get zoned, and then you open up. And they plan for that. But then the zoning takes longer. They're at the city, they're having troubles. So now they're at month six, they're not open because they're waiting on zoning, and rent is now due. And so now they're kicking out more cash and I bring it in. So that development incentive would save some of that. I think the other part of it too is incentivizing and advancing via providing resources for those who do not have a bunch of capital running around, right? So if you're an entrepreneur, and I talk about that a lot because in Philly, you know, there's very hard to get a liquor license. It's like $250,000 for a liquor license. So what you have is a lot of the culture, especially that subculture, being run by promoters. But they're at the whim of the owners, right? You know, and so especially when the owners are primarily older white men who are in this probably because it's a real estate thing. They care a little bit about life and if they're running some good stuff. But, you know, they are kind of placating some of the subculture. So, yeah, there's gay night at this bar, but where's the gay bar where you can go? Yeah, there's hip hop night here for that culture. Here's the EDM, you know, night, but where is the EDM culture? And so you have promoters that are jumping around from place to place to keep that subculture, you know, viable in the city. So one of the things we're talking about in Philly that advances is creating an incubator program where we take a promoter that you've already know how to bring the culture and the people in clearly, and we give you all the tools to be an owner. And then once you get all those tools, we give you resources to cover the cost of development, to cover the cost of a liquor license. So looking at, you know, unique and futuristic and innovative ways to advance, you know, nightlife and keeping it diverse and protecting that subculture. And I think that's a really important part. And one last thing before I turn over to Lauren, when we're talking about that development part. So this is a big project planned in Philadelphia down at our sports complex by Comcast. Comcast is our largest company in the city. And so they're looking to turn the entertainment district, which is all of our stadiums in one place, to a 24-hour, you know, round-the-clock economic driver. They're trying to add residential in there. And so one of the things we're engaging Comcast with at the city is, like, when you look at this plan, where's the plan for the entrepreneur? Where's the plan for the nightlife? Zone it. Make it easier so that you can have some move-in ready stuff when we're talking about it. So, and again, another great article there. You know, the people in the city are wanting it. Create more clubs and bars for those subset cultures. So, Lauren, I think you have some other great examples about advancing, too.
Yeah, next slide, please. All right. So, no matter what size you are, you know, whether you're a collective, a bar or a club, or a company like Resident Advisor, at every different level, there are ways that we can really reconsider how we reinvest, right? How we re-support subcultures so that we can lift people up. At RA, over the past year, we've run an incubator program called Make Space, and we also have a program called Access All Areas and Doors Open, which is very much about opening up access for workers in nightlife. This is a platform for jobs across all over the world, and the Make Space program specifically focuses on traditionally marginalized operators, because who's on the stage is important, but who's behind the scenes is just as important. We still have a large disparity in who owns and runs clubs, who directs festivals, right? Like, who makes those curatorial decisions? So we're trying to equal out the playing field across, you know, the whole breadth of it. MakeSpace has been really successful. This past year in the UK, we were able to expose over 5,000 people to new promoters and up-and-coming talent. And this was a very intentional program where we paired emerging promoters with clubs, like very famous clubs like Corsica Studios. We paired those guys up so that they could learn from one another and so that they could put on promoters in a space that normally they would never have access to. We know how hard it is, if you've done this work, to get a night at a club like that, you know, or a place that you revere. So we're trying to make that access a little bit more smooth and ensure that people's capacity is growing as they go along the way. Yep. Next slide, go for it.
A couple of, just add a couple of thoughts on tools to advance nightlife. Like Raheem was talking about, in California, or in San Francisco and a number of other counties in California, it's $250,000 for a liquor license. And music venues that want to admit patrons of all ages also get the requirement to run a kitchen, even though what they want to do is book bands, not serve meals. NEVA California, we worked closely with to develop and implement a new music venue liquor license. So it's available directly from the state, $19,000, which is still a lot of money, but not $250,000. And there is no kitchen requirement for all ages. So you can do ticketed live entertainment. This is radically and dramatically lowered the barrier to access to a liquor license to own a venue. Secondly, we have a state legislator representing San Francisco who is looking at expanding entertainment in cannabis, in the cannabis context. So can we have ticketed entertainment inside of dispensaries as an alternative form of performance space? You know, that all of the evidence I've heard is that young people are drinking alcohol less, and I think even more broadly, thinking about ways to nurture and sustain cultural spaces, performance venues that aren't driven by alcohol sales is a really important expansion of the conversation that we need to get past. And that doesn't just mean cannabis. That means thinking about other funding sources to have other types of spaces, other types of business models. Because I think it's really, you know, that there it's overdue.
And I've just got one policy idea that I want to emphasize. It expands on what Raheem talked about around incentives and a little bit about what Ben talked about earlier on cultural districts. Incentives are something that we've done here in Austin. We have a downtown density bonus, which essentially means you can build a taller building if you do certain things. Add affordable housing is one, but also add a cultural space or a live music venue. In that downtown program, the housing comes first, and we need more housing. But what we're looking at going forward and advancing is getting out of downtown, creating cultural districts all around the city, and then having an incentive tool where you can build more, a little taller, a little bigger, if you put a cultural or live music space in that building. So that's the incentive. And then on top of that, if we can make it where there's a legacy component, and if a venue has been in a space that's being redeveloped, well, you gotta put it back. So those are a couple of things we're looking at in terms of incentives in advancing the culture in the spaces.
Ryan, I think you bring up another great point that I want to put out there. A lot of cities are post-COVID facing downtown kind of population deficits, right? Their downtowns were so central business district, and they had these empty spaces, right? And, you know, you cannot fill every empty office tower residential, right? I know that's the thing, the residential conversion, but advancing is also being unique about where you're putting your cultural places. So, you know, now where typically there's either an office or a high-rise building, maybe this is a mixed-use building, you change the zoning, and there's bowling on the 40th floor, or the latest club or art gallery is on the 50th floor, which, again, solves a lot of that space issue, but, you know, opens up different places for leasing. But I think the other part of it, I think, and we all understand this, is that when you do that, you have to change your pricing model. because an office building square footage pricing is very different than what a cultural venue can pay. And so, but that cultural venue is going to have a big impact. It's going to bring people back to those downtowns and into those empty office spaces.
All right, so when we think about advancing, we're not always talking about infinite scalability and growth, right? Like advancing culture is not necessarily the same as advancing a product. And we have to, you know, we have to take into account for ourselves how we are going to make this industry more equitable, more sustainable, right, and more caring. So I think a deep part of this is listening to our communities. And we need to involve them in our decision-making processes. We know what's going on right now at South By. We know that artists want to have fair pay. That includes speakers and people that work for large corporations like this. But we really need to take that into account for ourselves. So we should hopefully question ourselves when we're starting businesses, putting on events, or curating people into our programs about how can we make this a collaborative process that is more equitable and sustainable. Personally, you know, I have seen and I feel that there are a lot of conflicts around involving weapons companies and festivals. You know, people have a lot of different opinions about this, but I would encourage South By, you know, to involve its artists and its communities in this decision-making process at the outset, because there are many different ways forward and there are many different ways to be sustainable. So I hope that for South By's future, and I hope that for all of our future, you know, that we constantly are questioning ourselves and thinking about different ways forward.
All right, so we talked about a lot, right? And so nightlife, it's a confluence of things to protect it, right? To preserve it and to advance it. And it crosses over into all the things we do: community, space, business, policy, innovation, and culture. That's all has to come together to continue to create vibrant cities that we want to live in, which is the new wave, right? People are not just moving for jobs anymore. They're also moving for that quality of life. And so that's what we wanted to leave with you guys to understand, that it can take so many things, but the most important part about preserving culturally vibrant cities is you guys. It's advocacy. It's raising your voice at the appropriate times. It's making sure that your elected officials understand that this industry, nightlife and entertainment, is just as important as any other industry, and that your vote is very important too versus someone who doesn't go out and is not trying to protect. And so what we want to do is open the floor up to see, again, we threw a lot at you guys about the protecting, preserving, and advancing of nightlife, but we want to know what type of questions that you have from what we talked about or anything else that you think when it comes to vibrant cities and nightlife, and especially entrepreneurship. There's a mic in the middle of the floor, so if you want to just go to the mic.
Awesome. And thank you so much. Yeah,
thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thanks for being here and listening. We're excited to chat with you.
Oh, look at this. Oh, wow. All right, great. Are we awake now?
We got 10 minutes.
I feel like I woke up during that.
11 so hopefully minutes.
We'll take our first question. Let's go.
God damn it, like 7 days in and I'm still like super nervous when I speak on the microphone. Sure. Anyways, thank you very much for all the different points, and I loved having like different cities that most of them I know, one I unfortunately didn't know yet. And loved the nightlife mayor part, because I heard that in the past before and I was waiting for that. Loved the non-alcoholic part because I don't drink. But especially loved the part where you said there are people in front of the bar, which is like us and dancing, but the people behind. Except for them, I feel like nighttime or nightlife was now defined just by partying and going out, right? But there are so many people working at night, like doing our mail, our little Amazon packages, cleaning the streets, you know, doing all these things that are, they're not sitting at South by Southwest in the audience. And their life could probably be improved by infrastructure and so on as well. Do you have ideas or anything to make that a 24-hour city, as you said? Because we all think of 24 hours, should we be awake all the time? No, it's not just me and my office job having to work at night. It's a completely different way of life. If you work at night, sleep during the day, even day parties are a thing for people who work at night because they can't party at night. Thank you very much for everything you've said. This might have been one of the best panels I've seen during the entire time that I was here since the first day, every day. Wow. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'll address that. You know, and one thing that is very important, and I tell people this all the time about my job as the night mayor or director of nighttime economy, the nightlife part is actually a really small portion of it. The goal of turning Philadelphia and some of these other U.S. cities into true 24-hour cities means that a true 24-hour city is defined as this: a city that has a plan for what it looks, feels, and operates like at 2 p.m. and at 2 a.m., and the people that move around at 2 a.m. have the same access to city services at 2 p.m. that they have, right? So we're talking, when I'm looking at programming and I'm thinking about infrastructure, when you work at a club or a restaurant, people assume that you ate when the kitchen was open. But a lot of times when the club closes at 2, you don't get out till 2:30 or 3, you haven't eaten. You know, if you work overnight in a hospital, right, you're a doctor, where do you, you know, handle your business at, right? If you work at night and sleep during the day, you know, how do you engage with the city? If you want to talk about your water bill or your taxes, you have to go out of your way, sacrifice sleep to handle the things that people who work during the day take for granted. So I think that is a very important part of the work that we all do. It's not just about, you know, partying all the time. It's about advancing services and those quality of life things that people who work at night need.
Let's keep going.
All right. I'm a city planner from Austin, but I live in this incredibly fussy town of Berkeley, California, famously tricky. So y'all are ninjas with this bureaucracy. Like, thank you. I'm really curious, as you know, we see amazing multi-generational activity in like Salvador, Brazil, in Colombia, in Nigeria, that I kind of think of as like more epic and inclusive than a lot of the US. Like, what do y'all look to these other places for, like, to learn from them?
I think, Lauren, you can talk about some of the work you did across in the UK.
Oh, man. Well, I mean, in Europe, there's funding. Like, in Europe, I mean, if we look to Europe, which is, has been a model for how we've started to incorporate, you know, thinking about the night in the States, it is considered on par with the opera, right? Like, spaces are getting funding and are acknowledged as cultural assets. They're valued as social assets. So it's completely integrated in how cities are being planned for. And I think that also, just the history of how those spaces have evolved, like, residents and community members just see it as part of their daily lives. So you see a lot more intergenerational mixing at clubs, but you also see, I'll just use it broadly, I'll call them sound places. You see sound places for all different ages, right, and types of interests that are also 24 hours. So going out at night doesn't mean you have to rage. I mean, there can be sound baths that go 24 hours. You know, there can be very calm experiences, again, that can provide a respite for people that are working, get off late, need to decompress for a minute, right? And so other cities have just been more flexible and more accepting about this and have seen it as integrated into the value of their culture.
Lauren, I think, you know, seeing these spaces as cultural spaces is really important, encouraging a diversity of activity and a diverse demographic. I mean, I think you mentioned some cities. I think when you go to New Orleans, I see a lot of intergenerational culture and nightlife. So it can be done, but we need to make sure these are treated as cultural spaces with diverse demographics, both encouraged, invited, and encouraged.
I'll add, from a city planning point of view, one thing that we can do is relax the regulations, right? When you're talking about Sao Paulo or Europe or, you know, Australia, they do a great job there. You know, they get more hours to operate. Here in the U.S., if you open a club, most of the time it's 10 to 2. If you're lucky in New York, you get till 4. But, you know, imagine that. You're paying 24-hour rent, 24-hour calls, but you're getting 6 hours max to operate that venue. If you relax
maybe
those...
Maybe 3 days a week.
Maybe 3 days a week, right. And if you relax those things, you open up the opportunity for people to one, provide a diversity of programming, you know, because a day party could be a different vibe than a nighttime rager. And then you give more opportunity for people to make money, right, to lower the margins. Because, you know, it's high margins in, or low margins, pardon me, in that nightlife. And that's from a city planning view, I think, that we could do here in the States. Yeah.
And just quickly, just to acknowledge that we provided a very U.S. city-specific presentation. But it is important to acknowledge the growing global movement around all of these topics and that we're all a part of and that we are continually learning from, and seeing the growth of the global movement is a really exciting part of this work, too.
Oh, that's a good segue to my question. So I'm a brewer in Singapore. And I plan to expand, like, have nightlife entrepreneurship in Southeast Asia. I've lived in San Francisco and Dallas and spent time in Austin, New York, New Orleans, etc. My question is, what is, like, in your opinion, in terms of either both from the entrepreneur's perspective and the city perspective, about, like, you know, like, imagine if only Sixth Street had clubs versus, like, there's West Street, Rainy Street, Sixth Street, like, what do you think of like all the nightlife being clustered in one part of the city versus different neighborhoods like Hayes Valley and Mission? So like, what do you guys think?
I have strong opinions on this. I think that it is a cop-out for cities to say, oh, and this will be the nightlife district, and we'll put it all there so it won't bother anybody, because people live everywhere, and people are increasingly living everywhere, and nightlife attracts residential development because people want to live near the cool stuff. So the whole idea of making one area the area where it's overtaxed for the resources, for the sidewalk space, for the rideshare access, for the like if the trash pick, if one area is going to be the nightlife district, that is just an incredibly challenging planning approach and approach from a city resources perspective. And I think ultimately then it leads to, or it is more likely to lead to conflicts where then it's, oh, we got to crack down, we got to limit the nightlife district because it just got out of control, which it was designed out of control. There wasn't control from the beginning.
I would love to jump in on that really quick. The other issue with, you know, thinking of just nightlife districts and putting them just in certain areas is that it will only create a monoculture, you know, that is only driven by the market, you know, not necessarily driven by people in place. So, for example, in New York, in every single neighborhood, there's a neighborhood up in Jackson Heights, Elmhurst, Corona. There's over 160 languages spoken in that neighborhood. It's an incredible place. Nightlife there, or anything that happens after 5 p.m., looks extremely different than what it looks like in Bushwick, which is like the Bermuda Triangle of clubs right now, you know? But both of them are equally important, you know? Like, and the way nightlife expresses itself in areas like Flushing, Queens, which has a very strong Korean, Chinese, and Spanish population, you know, that expresses itself a certain way. And that comes from its people, right? Okay. So having a distributed approach and allowing folks to customize what makes sense for them and their communities, I think, is the healthy way to go.
Okay, last quick comment on that, and then we'll take, I think, maybe two questions.
Yeah.
But, you know, those districts you mentioned in Austin were developed organically because we're pretty deregulated here. So we didn't intend to create those districts. They happened on their own, and so we need to struggle to manage them and get them more diverse. But the goal is what Ben said, is that there's culture and nightlife everywhere in every district, so people have access to it everywhere.
All right, we have about two more minutes, and we'll try to get some quick questions in.
And we'll be
around afterwards.
Unless you get kicked out, we can keep going.
I
want to hear your questions.
But yeah, we'll go until we can. But we'll try to be quick with it.
Thank you.
Sure, I'll try to speak quickly. So I live in Plymouth, Massachusetts, which is going through sort of a nightlife growth right now. As sort of a luxury of that, we have the luxury of that being driven in large part by retirees, which helps with a lot of what would otherwise be generational gaps and opinions as to what good looks like as far as entertainment is concerned. However, part of your strategy, it sounds like, universally, is to set expectations as to what noise will be, as well as to make sure that people are saying, hey, this is exactly what it's going to be. Here's how we compensate. You have compensating controls built into your designs. Expectations, when they're set, need to be maintained and enforced. And something I haven't really seen in my own direct experience are good strategies for maintaining that, to basically enforce, you know, are we not exceeding the allowable noise, the allowed time in the allowed places.
Yeah, I think a good way of I guess, meeting those expectations and maintaining them, right? So Scottsdale, Arizona does lease and deed addendums in their entertainment districts, right? And so when you move in or buy a house, you sign and say, I know I'm moving in a place that has a different noise, you know, requirement.
Sure.
What they also say to maintain that, right, not just at the beginning, if you call city services to complain about these things during these times, we won't waste dollars and respond, right? So that's one, setting an expectation, that's also managing it as well. But then on the other time, they have a very strict enforcement for the venues on the other side to make sure that they are also keeping in with. So I think you can set those things and then continue to follow up with them, like having that a part of the process.
Yeah. Well, let's quickly.
Okay, yeah, quickly. San Francisco entertainment venues all have conditions on their permits, and one of them is a good neighbor policy. And a sound limit and any other conditions that come up. So, you know, continuing to maintain open lines of communication with nearby residents, sticking to the sound limit, and those conditions can change over time if they need to, right? And so I think being transparent, being consistent, being knowing when things need to change in the terms of operation, and sometimes conditions can be loosened after good operation. Things are successful, great, let's add more hours, you know? So I think it goes both ways, but I absolutely agree that ongoing, you know, ensuring responsible management on an ongoing basis is really a critical part.
And predictability is critical for us. I mentioned it a lot. And so that comes with accountability as well. We've made the venue spaces legal, but we also then need to be responsive and make sure they're compliant so everyone's expectations are managed and we deliver on it. So we've got civilian staff, not the police department, who's, you know, has higher priorities and can't respond. We're responsive. Provide education, do the mediation, but ultimately, if someone is really out of line, deal with that as well.
Thank you.
All right, we are at time, but if we're not getting pressured, we'll take the last two questions. Let's go, we'll take the last two questions, come on.
Cool, and could you put up the mentee while we talk, because we have one last little, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, I'm a former urban designer. I restored a 100-year-old bar in a forgotten neighborhood in Detroit, Michigan. And this year we were nominated as one of the top 30 cocktail bars in America from Tales
Congrats.
Of the Cocktail.
Awesome.
Can you tell us what it is?
Kiesling. It's like Riesling, but with a K.
Nice.
Thank you. One of the beautiful things about the bar is we built it to unify all of the residents. We have a $5 beer and shot. We have craft cocktails. We are trying to bring up the hospitality community, which has been decimated there after decades of flight. So we're bringing in guest bars from other states and other countries to do guest shifts, teach classes for not just our bar staff, but the entire community. The challenge, and what I would love your feedback on, is we are a closed state. We have liquors that are delisted at random. We have no idea how many have been ordered, when they've been ordered. The state, it's a blind system from prohibition, and a few people benefit from it, but small businesses do not. So for programs like ours, where we're trying to create a diverse offering, or other small businesses trying to do that, we're really handcuffed here. And then also trying to create this program for guests coming in, we can't batch for them. Yeah. Advice.
So, yeah. Alcohol policy is one of the least well understood areas of what it takes to run successful small businesses. Policymakers don't understand the implications on the ground for programs like yours. In San Francisco, a $250,000 liquor license means excluding a significant number of people from the ability to open a restaurant in neighborhoods that have very few restaurants. Yeah. We worked with state legislators, again, who didn't know, what do you mean it takes two? What do you mean you need $250,000? Right? Like it's yeah. So educating policymakers that this is not about, people hear alcohol and they think it's just, you know, like open bar shots, like, you know. But understanding the real-world implications of alcohol policy, telling that story locally and then at the state, and like there are ways to tell that story in a way that is not seen as, you know, it's not blowing up the liquor licensing system. It's just about building a more equitable and sustainable future, which is there's absolutely pathways to do that through advocacy, education, and then state level activism.
Yeah. I'll add on really quickly, because you know Pennsylvania is a state that's very similar when it comes to controlling liquor. It's actually out of pocket. But one of the things that I do myself, one, getting an advocate inside government matters. When I'm talking about expanding hours and giving more, you know, opportunities for business owners, I talk about it as an equity thing. You know, like, because states are always looking at how to help small businesses. I'm like, you can help and create more wealth in your state, especially a city like Detroit or a city like Philly, who definitely struggles with minority wealth in those cities, yep. right? And it's because the barrier to entry is so high. $250,000 to get a liquor license in Philadelphia as well. Pennsylvania has issued a new liquor license, so you get them off an exchange. And they've been up to $1 million before. Pre-pandemic, a liquor license was almost $1 million. It dropped down, so it gets crazy. But talking about it from economic, you know, development standpoint, again, in that equity part, it's not about the liquor. It's about giving people opportunity to make money in their own city, in their own state, in their own neighborhood.
Right on. Thank you.
And liquor license reforms are a $0 way that states can... If states, they don't need to spend any money, they just need to fix the laws.
And if you want to deep dive on that after this, come talk to us.
Yeah. I do.
We can get into the weeds on that.
I'm also a documentary filmmaker, and I want to connect with you guys on this, and anyone else in here who is interested in this, yes,
we'd love
please.
That.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Great, thank you.
Hey, let's keep going.
I mean, listen, till they close us
out.
We
got lucky with the time. Thank you, guys. I'll try to keep mine shorter than I originally thought. I think like Rainey is kind of like a microcosm of everything you guys have been talking about. I really liked what you guys said about preserving and advancing, like kind of preserving the culture more than preserving the buildings. And so speaking of Rainey, I saw an example where there was a building that was planning to have a bunch of like small bar and restaurant spaces in the bottom, like be open to the neighborhood. It's a new high-rise building, which you know people are always worried about in these neighborhoods, but they're planning to be open. Then the interest rates went up and they had to change it, be just purely residential, not mixed use anymore. So kind of like someone here's from Singapore, I think, Tokyo, Hong Kong, you see a lot of high rises there that have more like mixed use. I was wondering, like, how do we encourage private developers who we can't like force to do things, but how do we encourage them to kind of do more stuff like that?
I think that's where the incentive comes in, but it has to be an incentive that means something to them. So it has to be calibrated, right? So they're getting value and they're putting in a community value, which means a cultural space. Rainey's a real difficult situation. We can talk later, but you know, it was zoned for high rises and the market wasn't there. So it turned into all like bars and clubs first. Now the high rise market is there and that's what's being built. It was zoned for it. It just took a while. That was 2005. We're seeing it now, though.
It happened, like,
it's crazy.
I think that's another good example of how cultural venues are really stopgap measures, because when you look at gentrification in neighbors, a lot of times it was industrial, and this is definitely in up north in Philadelphia. Industrial, then abandoned when we lost a lot of manufacturing, and then cultural venues jumped into these old neighborhoods. That's why you're like warehouse districts are always entertainment. Brewery town we have in Philly, you know, the factory district, because entertainment came in, cultural spaces, and now the residents are back and using these cool names. They're like, oh, you know, condos and warehouses and stuff. But, you know, again, I think Rainey is, I guess, a good example of how the culture came in, you know, made an opportunity.
Filled a vacuum. It was always going to be temporary.
Yeah.
Should we take our last one?
There we go.
Thank you.
Yay.
All right. So first, since I first heard about the nighttime economy manager position last year, I've learned so much wisdom. Being able to live in Philadelphia, to seeing the impact that Raheem makes. Heron, you speak last year and connecting with you, all amazing points of view. So as far as being a consumer, I would like to know, is there like a quote unquote CNN, like a central nightlife network that us as a consumer can, because you guys, we've built that trust with you. Whenever I need to know what to do tonight, I just ask Raheem. You know, so, and if I go to a different city, I would love to have that same trusted, you know, guide. So, yeah, is that anything for a consumer?
All right, and I don't mean this as self-promotion.
Go ahead, Mark. Shameless plug.
No, so there's a couple, and I'll bring up a few names because they all work in parallel with each other, which is what I think is cool, and they all come at this from their own expertise. So Resident Advisor has been putting on club culture and from writing amazing editorials, deep dives, to event listings for over 20 years. It's an independent company. It's still independently owned and run, and so that's obviously why I'm on their board. I believe in their mission. But RA, you can find stuff all over the world. Vibe Lab is a network that we're all part of, which has been really behind like the policy kind of finding different ways to fund nightlife and different ways for us to think about how to support nightlife. So if you look at Vibe Lab Network.
Vibe Club?
Vibe Lab Network. Vibe and you Lab. Can, well, if you yeah, guys want we'll to email us, our information's on, you know, the speaker page. We'll find a way maybe even to share back with you these kind of pro tips. But RA, Vibe Lab Network,
Nightcap.
So I'll plug Nightcap all very, really quickly. Yeah, they're all peers, but they all come at it from different angles, right? So you can look at those resources for kind of different things.
Yeah, and one thing about Nightcap is we have like a membership for the consumer or people who want to support. It's an organization where we, as you know, managers get around and we talk about the policies and the changes and best practices. But you can join Nightcap as well and one, be supportive of the work that we're doing, but also find out about the innovative things that we are talking about, because we're releasing papers about sound management, about supporting artists and cultural venues. So Nightcap is, again, that's the one we represent on the board. Please feel free to check us out. Join. It's a very simple and not that expensive membership to support and find out information.
And it's Night, N-I-T-E hyphen cap .org.
Perfect.
N-I-T-E hyphen cap .org.
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you all
thank
so
you
much.
All.
This
thank
has
you.
Really been great.
And thank you to South By for not, sending the Sandman
thank
out.
Thank you for having us. I hope you guys have a great time. If you look on our speaker page and you want to contact us, all of our information is up there. We'd love to hear from you and keep talking. So thanks.